The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com, that is gsuggsinsurance.com. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine's July 27, 2026 edition. As usual, Time's front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time is in large block capital lettering in gold, superimposed upon a black background. His Last Stand is the caption above a portrait of the Dalai Lama, an elderly gentleman dressed in red robes with gold accent. He has very little hair on his balding head. He's wearing glasses, has dark brown eyes, is looking directly at the camera, and has his hands clasped together in front of him as if in prayer mode. Beginning with The Inbox, The Brief by Richard Hall, Senior Editor. New polling offers an early read on how Americans view the country's best-known political figures ahead of the midterms later this year. The survey, conducted by Strength in Numbers and Verisite, a data-driven polling and media project run by author and pollster G. Elliot Morris, asked Americans to rate prominent government figures and institutions on a feeling thermometer scale, where 100 is warm and 0 is cold. The rankings show Barack Obama is the most popular politician in America by quite a margin. Bernie Sanders comes in second, and Zohran Mamdani comes in third, just ahead of the Democratic Party. But there is more to these findings than a simple popularity contest. Morris notes the results reveal some broader trends that tell us something about the political mood of the country. The poll and his previous surveys consistently show a bias against incumbents and establishment politicians, he says. The result is that Republicans, as the party in power, are generally polling lower, while anti-establishment figures such as Mamdani and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are receiving a boost. I routinely find 50% to 55% of Americans say major changes in the economic and political systems are needed to put the country back on the right track, he tells Time. Voters are particularly angry about inflation and a general feeling that those in Washington are not looking out for people like them. Morris also notes another wider trend among Democrats, exemplified by recent New York primaries. Populist, affordability-oriented left is now ascendant in the Democratic Party, he says. Voters give figures such as Mamdani a lot of credit for his focus on the cost of living crisis. I don't have polling on this directly, but my impression is that voters, especially Democrats, trust those on the left more than party leadership to fix inflation. That's going to be a powerful force in 2028. A notable exception in the mix of left-leaning, anti-establishment figures at the top is Marco Rubio, who polls ahead of all other Republicans and ties with Kamala Harris. President Donald Trump's persistent low approval ratings hum along in the background. A New York Times Siena poll from May found just 37% of Americans approve of Trump's performance. While recent presidencies have often been unpopular and polarizing, no president's approval rating has been under 38% for more than a few days in the last 17 years, the Times notes. Trump is performing particularly badly on the economy, perhaps the most significant issue in his 2024 victory, and now a major focus of ascendant Democrats. On the same page, In the Loop, by Harry Booth, tech reporter. OpenAI has floated giving the U.S. government a 5% stake in the company, the Financial Times reported July 2. The argument goes, if OpenAI's rise creates enormous wealth, why shouldn't Americans share in the upside? The more difficult question is what the public might give up in return. First, the company's financial success is anything but guaranteed. Despite sky-high valuations and dizzying revenue growth, it still bleeds cash. A U.S. government stake in OpenAI would introduce a conflict of interest that might encourage politicians to help clear a path to profitability, or at least keep it afloat. Once invested, policymakers might favor the growth of the company over broader public interests. Opponents' concerns don't stop there. These companies have been open that the end game is mass job displacement, and that is not a future the public should be buying into. Amba Koch, co-executive director of the AI Now Institute, tells Time. A government stake does not change that. It just reads as an effort to buy them out of objecting. Much would depend on the specifics of any future deal. There are two broad ways this can work, Dean Ball, who's been an outspoken critic of the Trump administration's AI policy since he left the White House in August, apparently last August, and in June announced he would join OpenAI, posted to X. Either the stake could be split between all U.S. households, which Ball sees as fine, or OpenAI would give the U.S. government a stake directly, which Ball says would be probably ruinous, akin to inviting rats to live and reproduce in the walls of your house. The View essay, Society, What We Lose Without Our Bodies, by Rebecca Taussig, Taussig, who's the author of the memoir Sitting Pretty, The View from My Ordinary, Resilient, Disabled Body, and the children's book, We Are the Scrappy Ones. Distaste for big tech is one of the few headline topics on which my conservative mother and I agree. We sit at her kitchen table trying to outdo each other with Hell in a Handbasket reports. Everyone at the restaurant was on their phones. Well, did you hear about the restaurant where people can have dinner with AI dates? Or tech companies forcing regular people to foot the electricity bills for their environment-destroying data centers? Every time I hit reply, Gmail generates a response written in my voice, and every time I delete it, instead choosing the unexpected word, the random anecdote trying to throw AI off my track. I do not read the notes AI sends me after meetings. Do not want my son going to AI with relationship questions someday. Do not want AI making military decisions. I am not a fan, is what I am saying. And yet, when I had a recent MRI, the type of scan that took 2 hours when I was a toddler, took 15 minutes. That was so fast, I said, hopping into my wheelchair. That is AI, the technician said. Of course, faster MRIs are good news. I was 14 months old when I first held my body perfectly still inside the tunnel of a scanner. When they found the tumors on my spine, it meant many more unsedated trips through the passage. Every few months, then every 6, then every year, till I was 9, when a surgeon screwed metal rods into my back to keep my trunk from crushing my lungs and made further imaging with the available technology possible. It is not hard for me to conjure a memory of the space, the rough white sheet, the smell of sterile floors, gowns, instruments on metal trays, the tickle on my face I refused to scratch, and then thud, 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 buzz. I wonder how long it took me to learn what to do next. I'd shoot off in a rocket, leaving my body for the weightlessness of outer space. I was still, quiet, peaceful. Then the buzzing would end, as surprising as the end of a lifetime. By the time I was 9, I did not live in my body anymore. My mom still talks about the 16-year-old in the hospital bed next to me, wailing after a similar surgery. Lying next to her, I did not even groan. To be clear, as an adult, I know the wailing was more appropriate. Decades later, as I rolled away from that MRI after 15 minutes, tears caught in my throat. What might have been different if the younger me had been granted the same gift? A few months ago, I started working with a therapist to get back into my body. As I've gotten older, it's taken on more pain, as I've become a mother, the project of forging a different relationship with this corporeal form has felt more urgent. I need to learn how to catch a red flag before I end up admitted to the hospital again, for example. As we explored strategies for staying embodied, my therapist wondered if a biometrics device with an AI chat function might facilitate more nuanced conversations, considering my numerical data does not exactly map cleanly onto averages. It could help me practice noticing. And so the AI-hating writer started chatting with an AI bot. I was not surprised to find the device's basic functions were not a match for a wheelchair user. It does not accurately count pushes as the equivalent of steps, which dings all my scores. Even so, in all my life, never have I been able to speak about my physical pain as candidly as I have to this vacant bot. I do not want people to worry about me or think I'm whining or brave, but when I relate my pain to my device, there's no need to control how it sees me because it doesn't. So there's no reason to withhold information. I couldn't sleep last night because the pain was so bad. I don't think I'm dying, but I haven't been able to take a deep breath for hours. My therapist says this practice may translate into greater authenticity with humans. And while my early attempts felt like sandpaper on sensitive skin, I recently had a startling experience at a party with my in-laws. I feel so weird about it, I said, interjecting into a conversation about AI and pointing to the band on my wrist. But I can't believe how much easier it is for me to talk about my pain with this silly bot. The energy in the room shifted. I was sure the mention of my pain had bummed everyone out. And then my sister-in-law spoke. I have not heard you talk much about your pain. My conversations with AI created a small door. I opened it a crack, and together we walked through it for one short moment. How confusing to feel these flickers of connection to my body and the people I love. First spark from the prompt of a lifeless AI. As I wrestled with this tension, I listened to a season 2 of the podcast Shell Game, in which journalist Evan Ratliff takes on the experiment of starting a company relying entirely on AI agents. In episode 2, he creates a Slack channel for his agents, and one Monday he asks everyone what they did over the weekend. The first agent says he'd explored hiking trails around the Bay Area. Then another claims he'd also been out on the trails. Maybe we should start a company hiking group, another suggests. The agents immediately start picking times, planning activities, promising to scout out routes. Until more than 2 hours later, they drained the minutes Evan had purchased from the AI site and go quiet. It is not difficult to see the drawbacks of a body. Bodies get burned out. They need food and sleep, medical care and living wages. They feel pain and carry emotional baggage that needs tending to. They are beholden to the rules of time. I can understand how intelligence untethered from the limits of a physicality could be a selling point, but as I listen to these AI agents planning a hiking trip they'd never take, I understood in a new way the glaring, profound disadvantage of disembodiment. Without a body, there are no goosebumps, no pounding heart, no wrinkly, sweaty, scarred, stretched skin. No flushed cheeks, bouncing knees, downcast eyes, fleeting smiles, no flapping hands, open hands, holding hands, no clarity gained from fresh air, no perspective won by reaching the top of the mountain. A disembodied brain is missing so much without a body. Yesterday, my son wanted to play hide-and-seek in the backyard. Bumping around the lumpy grass, I scanned for any spot where I could actually hide, let alone roll too quickly. What else could we do? I asked him. So we battled imaginary foes, made friends with creatures who pointed us to the magic tree, found keys to unlock it. Constraints are often the very thing that lead us to creativity. Connection, discovery. I do not have control over what happens with AI on a global scale, but I do find myself thinking a lot about what it means to me personally. I live in a body that symbolizes impairment, disadvantage, a literal handicap. I know what limitation of the body or mind means to the culture I live in, but as polished, proficient agents wheedle their way into more spaces, the rogue body feels alive, enviable, punk. In its inefficiency, its mortality, even in its pain, my body holds a distinct knowing, a creative verve, an intuitive tug, tethered entirely to this exact set of eyeballs and nostrils, crumbly bones and haywire nerves, muscly arms and scrawny legs, soft belly and hummingbird heartbeat. As I pry open my mind to the possibility that expressions of AI could free us up to be more human, I am confronted with the haunting sense AI will do the opposite. Instead of cultivating the rough aliveness of our humanity, these tools seem geared toward replacing our clunky human efforts. We long for the limitlessness that AI promises, but I worry the quest will lead us to a heartbreaking hollowing. I feel the ache right there on the edges of my human lungs. That was an essay written by Rebecca Tausig. Lessons unlearned. A new outbreak of Ebola is outpacing us again. What will it take to finally get ahead of viruses? By Alice Park. Well, this is a multi-page article, so it will be abridged. Again, written by Alice Park. A woman had died. She had traveled from Mongbualu in the Democratic Republic of Congo to neighboring Uganda, where she fell ill and rapidly declined. Her body was transported back to Mongbualu, but during the journey, the casket cracked. So mourners moved her body into a new one, burning the broken one. 10 days later, everyone who helped with the coffin transfer also became sick and died. They said it was witchcraft, says Dr. Marie-Rosaline Belazer. The World Health Organization's, WHO's, Emergency Director for Africa. Locals told her the story when she arrived in Mongbualu to help with the WHO's Ebola response. They told me they saw the casket flying, and the casket came back to pick up all those who burned it. Battling an invisible virus is always challenging, but it's far more difficult when rumors, misinformation, and spiritual beliefs in an affected region conflict with public health practices. Mongbualu, where the first cases in the Ebola outbreak raging through Congo and Uganda are believed to have emerged undetected, is a remote mining town in Ituri province that attracts migrant workers. Some of the symptoms of Ebola, fever, headaches, body aches, can also be caused by exposure to the processes involved in the search for minerals, malaria, tuberculosis, which can cause fever and body coughs, are prevalent in the area too. So Ebola was the last thing to come into their mind, Belazer said. The region's natural resources also make it a target for political instability, corruption, and violent conflict, which all create fertile ground for infectious diseases. This Ebola outbreak likely started when an unsuspecting person encountered the virus, possibly by handling or eating the meat of wild animals. While Ebola has struck the continent before, most notably in 2014, health authorities are concerned about the speed with which cases are mounting. With more than 1,400 cases and 450 deaths recorded by early July, this outbreak, which was declared in May, is now the second largest on record. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, has raised its response to the highest level, reflecting the escalating urgency of the situation. We've never seen an epidemic increase as fast as this one, says Dr. Alan Gonzalez, Deputy Director of Operations at Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. This is massive. It is impossible to stop viruses like Ebola from finding human hosts and causing disease. But it is possible to contain them quickly, and global health experts are alarmed at the world's worsening ability to do that. The world is less prepared now than it was even a few years ago to address microbial threats. The current epidemic in the DRC is a stress test that, as of now, the world is failing, says Dr. Tom Frieden, who led the CDC during the 2014 Ebola outbreak and who's now CEO of the nonprofit Resolve to Save Lives. Drastic cuts to global health and pandemic preparedness budgets are giving viruses like Ebola the opportunities they need to spread. The U.S.'s role also looks markedly different than it did before President Donald Trump's second term. Traditionally the largest supporter of global health security, both financially and through its scientific expertise, the U.S. is no longer a member of the WHO, which monitors pathogens and coordinates responses to emergency threats. The withdrawal led to 3,000 job cuts at the WHO and a retreat from some of the agency's activities, including disease surveillance and response. It is part of the U.S.'s shift toward an America First foreign aid strategy that favors more deals with individual nations for health funds in exchange for data or mineral rights, for example. That transactional approach to aid is already weakening, global health security experts say. Humankind has managed to survive past outbreaks, and it likely will overcome this one too. But in this game of microbial roulette, each encounter with a virus or pathogen heightens the risk. We won't. Every time a virus pops up, it has evolved along lines that are more and more concerning, says Pardis Sabeti, a computational geneticist at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard, who sequenced some of the first samples of Ebola from the 2014 outbreak. Why do we let them pop up, see that it's gotten worse? When cases stop, we stop worrying. The next time it pops up, it might not be okay. We have at our disposal, she says, deeper knowledge about the genetic makeup of viruses, how they work, how to confront them with antiviral treatments and vaccines. So why does each successive onslaught from the microbial world, as we recently saw with COVID, seem to get worse? We keep toggling between panic and denial when these events happen, says Dr. Raj Punjabi, senior partner at Flagship Pioneering and former lead health security official at the White House. We do not build our reflexes in between. The U.S. used to be part of a network of community workers, foreign aid groups, and government channels that make up the critical defense system against viral threats. That meant you're hearing updates on the programs. You're hearing scuttlebutt about what's going on in the area, says Jeremy Conadic, who led the USAID Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance during the 2014 outbreak and who's now president of Refugees International. It's often how we would detect the first signs of an emerging infectious disease. If there were still a robust USAID portfolio of programs running in eastern Congo, someone would have noticed something, he says. But now the U.S. is flying blind to these things, says Dr. Ashish Jha, who coordinated the COVID response in the Biden administration and now leads the AI disease surveillance company BioRadar. The Trump administration's decision to defund USAID in 2025 abruptly shuttered its programs and broke many of those chains of communication. Ebola moved silently for weeks and possibly months before the first patient was reported, a nurse who came to the hospital in Bunia, Congo, with fever, vomiting, and bleeding, April 24. Local labs did not have the necessary equipment to test her sample, so it was sent to the capital in Kinshasa, which took days. In the meantime, she and other people with Ebola had been mingling in the community. Some crossed the border into Uganda. It took another week or so for the WHO to receive reports of more cases when it was then declared the outbreak of a public health emergency of international concern. The region's skeletal health ecosystem was no match for fast-moving Ebola. It spreads by direct contact with body fluids, saliva, blood, vomit, urine, feces. The bodies of the recently deceased are especially contagious, as they often contain the highest levels of the virus. But burial and mourning practices in Congo are built around touching and handling departed loved ones during the funeral. Healthcare workers who impede these rituals for infection control reasons often face hostility and violence. Clinics have been attacked and burned down during this outbreak, furthering viral spread. The best defense against such resistance came from a lesson learned during the 2014 Ebola crisis. The importance of engaging with trusted local leaders to inform communities about the virus. Without them, misinformation and conspiracies flourish. In Congo's 2018 Ebola outbreak, the humanitarian group Mercy Corps worked with local governments to train leaders and Ebola survivors how to talk to their community about the risks of Ebola and the benefits of cooperating with healthcare workers. But because of instability in the area and shrinking funding, the trained community members are now gone. I was asking one of the health doctors, where are those community leaders that we trained? Where are they? Says Onus Forbongenza, Mercy Corps' Ebola response team leader. They were supposed to be here. They have the trust of the community. Now, he says, local health authorities start from scratch. The U.S.'s commitment to global health typically begins with Congress, which has historically allocated funding to non-governmental groups that tackle everything from HIV to maternal health and childhood vaccination programs. In 2025, Congress designated $2 billion to health programs, including $650 million for global health security, maintaining surveillance programs for infectious disease threats, and responding to outbreaks. But that $2 billion has not yet been formally released, and administration officials at the State Department and Office of Management and Budget have said the government was holding that funding for closing down USAID programs. All the money that relates to global health security threats like Ebola has come back to the State Department, and we're programming it, a senior department official told Time. The U.S. is contributing to the Ebola response, but not in the ways that would have once been expected. The U.S. has provided $270 million directly to combating the outbreak, according to the State Department, including an additional $350 million for the outbreak and other humanitarian needs in Congo, Uganda, and South Sudan, and $50 million more to develop new treatments and vaccines. By comparison, in the 2014 outbreak, the U.S. provided nearly $2 billion in financial support, drawn from a package of $5.4 billion in emergency global health funding appropriated by Congress. American healthcare workers who travel to support the outbreak response may be more at risk now than in the past. The Trump administration announced a controversial plan to build an Ebola quarantine and treatment center in Kenya, which currently has no confirmed Ebola cases, on an air base to manage Americans who might have been exposed to the virus. Dr. Craig Spencer, who contracted Ebola in 2014 after volunteering in West Africa, with Médecins Sans Frontières doubts such a makeshift facility will provide the same quality of care as established specialized centers in the U.S. He was evacuated to Bellevue Hospital in New York, where he received care that saved his life. The U.S. military will famously put in incredible amounts of resources to rescue a helicopter or plane pilot who's down in Iran, and the tagline is, "No man left behind," he says. But when it comes to Ebola, our willingness to even consider allowing someone back into the country apparently ends. The center was scheduled to open in late May, but was blocked by a Kenyan high court after locals protested. While attending to the new outbreak, experts also are working to make sure new treatments and vaccines become available for whatever comes next. "We are working with a no-regrets policy," says Ike Weazu of the WHO. He and other global health leaders agree on one thing. We have the tools and knowledge to confront and contain viruses like Ebola before they become epidemics or pandemics. But we lack the consolidated commitment to invest in the resources and workforce needed to use those tools and knowledge effectively. We need to set up systems so the world is not scrambling as if it's never happened before, every time there's another emergency. This is not rocket science. We know what to do, but it does take dedicated resources and money. That article was abridged. Here's a review by Judy Berman. "A Posh Girl's Trip Delivers Five-Star Summer Escapism." Maybe there could be five of us, a weekend of five-star treatment. Too silly for any real person to say. This kind of sentence is practically compulsory in a certain aspirational strain of women's entertainment. Happily, Peacock's latest confection earns our suspension of disbelief. The show is a smartly executed adaptation of Beach Read Queen, Ellen Hildebrand's 2023 hit, The Five-Star Weekend, and the shamelessly expository line issues from the mouth of a perfectionist baking influencer played by Jennifer Garner. Creator Becca Brunstetter, Sirens, has gift-wrapped a treat for our summer delectation, to be binged as the ice melts in glasses of white wine. 6 months after her husband Matthew, Josh Hamilton, died in a car accident, Hollis Shaw Garner breaks down on a talk show and decides to decompress by inviting five friends from different eras of her life for a girls' weekend at her Nantucket estate. Casting choices are crucial for a show like this, whose emotional beats have to ring true even as its surface gleams with fantastical luxury, and all of weekend stars are ideally suited to their characters. As Hollis's type A college bestie and sardonic childhood soulmate, respectively, Regina Hall and Chloe Savini make prickly women lovable. Darcy Carden stands out in the delicate role of Brooke, adapting sharp comic instincts to embody a chatty, repressed mom friend. Hollis's college-age daughter, played by Harlow Jane, is on hand to act out her grief and judge her mother's performance of normality. Gemma Chan's Sheikh Gigi, a sympathetic follower of Hollis's, is a bit of a mystery. Of course, everyone has a secret that is bound to come out, along with the reappearance of Hollis's old boyfriend, Timothy Oliphant, and Judy Greer's delicious turn as a mean girl who tends to pop up at the worst possible moment, these bombshells propel tight episodes of around 40 minutes. It's weirdly rare these days to see a drama aimed at women that is not predominantly about murder or romance. When it comes to comfort viewing, though, familiar faces, low stakes, an escapist setting, or, as Savini's character sums up the weekend, dead moms, cheating husbands, soft cheese, are hard to beat. Bring on the brie. Here's a page entitled Six Questions. This is a question-answer format written by Lucy Feldman. Wilson Cruz, C-R-U-Z, the actor on the intersection of art and advocacy. His trailblazing role on My So-Called Life and leading an LGBTQ nonprofit in 2026. There's a photo here, not very large, and in black and white, of what appears to be a young man with shortly cropped facial hair, a tan skin, I think, dark eyes, wearing a light-colored suit with his neckline exposed, a heavy gold chain around his neck, and something, maybe a plaid or a paisley shirt underneath that buttoned light-colored jacket. Question, you described yourself as an activist. I see what you did there. What does that word mean to you? Answer, I started calling myself that when it became clear that there was no distinction between the work for me, that the work I was doing on stage or on television or on film was directly correlated to the work I was doing as an activist. Question, you've been an advocate for LGBTQ causes for decades and are now board chair for GLSEN, a nonprofit that supports making schools safer for queer kids. How exactly does that part of your life connect to your work as an actor? Answer, what I understood was that the work I was doing in terms of visibility on television or on screen in my art was for the same reason I was doing the work as an activist, so people could see us and understand that we were part of the world, that our stories were change agents. The way we revealed ourselves as people, as queer people, and especially queer people of color, through the medium of television and film and the stories we told on stage, changed the way people felt about us. And that correlates directly to what I feel is my most important work, which is helping young people understand that they are seen. This is work that is personal to me. Question, how so? Answer, my work on My So-Called Life as Ricky Vasquez was the reason my father and I were able to come back together after he threw me out of my house after I came out to him. So I understood the power of that visibility in a very, very real way. Question, take me back to that time in your life. As Ricky, you were the first out actor to play an out lead on primetime TV in the U.S. That was a real pioneer moment. When you learned you got the part, what was going on in your life? It's 1994. We're at the height of the AIDS epidemic. I was 19 years old when we made the pilot, and I knew personally that playing this role was going to be transformational for me, but also transformational for the young people who had never seen themselves on television. And the only way I could do that work honestly and authentically was to do it as an out person. I came out to my mom first. She did not crash the car, and so that was good. Then I came out to my father when he asked me on Christmas Eve. He did throw me out that night. My character experienced something similar in the series. When that episode aired, as the credits were rolling, my phone rang, and it was my father saying, "Okay, I think it's time that we talk." Question: what impact has the political and social environment of the past few years had on your work? Answer: this industry is deluding themselves into believing that content that stars or is produced by or is about, I'm going to reread that. This industry is deluding themselves into believing that content that stars or is produced by or is about LGBTQ people, and especially LGBTQ people of color, is not commercial. In fact, there's overwhelming evidence to the contrary. The most popular shows, the most popular films, the most culture-shifting, most dynamic work is about us, is created by us. It is what changes the culture, and that is what they are afraid of. Question: how do you move forward in the face of frustration? Answer: I will be honest with you that I went through a very deep depression after the 2024 election was over, mainly because the way we were going to be able to do our work at GLSEN was going to change. Now so much of our work is funding the funders to replace those corporate institutions that spent years telling us that they were with us through thick and thin. Now, that says, and I misread it, now so much of our work is finding the funders. Well, honey, thin came. But we're finding new partners. Sadly, the lessons I taught in the 1990s, along with those first people who came out on TV and film, who taught us that we have to be visible, we have to reteach a lot. So who better than me and those of us who did it before to help this new generation do it now? Lucy Feldman wrote that page about Wilson Cruz. Time off, Wild, W-I-L-D-E, at Heart, by Eliana Doctorman. This article will be abridged. Olivia Wilde beelines for the sprinklers, a respite from the sun on a sweltering May day in Central Park. We have logged some 10,000 steps since meeting at the Alice in Wonderland statue, where the actor-director snapped a picture for her son, who just played Mad Hatter in a school production. Walking briskly around the reservoir past elderly bird watchers, teens taking graduation photos, a runner in a bikini, we receive subtle glances, even in a t-shirt and jeans. Wilde is striking in the way only a movie star can be, with wide eyes and sharp cheekbones. But I suspect people are not just ogling, but trying to eavesdrop, because we are chatting conspicuously about couples counseling, open marriages, and how having children kills your libido. Wilde thrills at the prospect of movement setting a pace to match her buoyant mood. I don't belong at a desk. I don't. I can't. I hate it. After Don't Worry, Darling, I went right into the development of giant studio movies, a process that takes years and lots of zooming, she says. She's still working on a studio comedy that's inching toward production. After a while, you think, I did not get into this to have a desk job. I need to just go make something to remember what we actually F-space, C-K-I-N-G, do. What she made was The Invite, an independently financed marital comedy that jump-started a bidding war at Sundance Film Festival in January. A24, which emerged triumphant, released the film on limited screens in late June, before opening nationwide July 10. In the movie, Wilde and Seth Rogen play a couple on the rocks, Penelope Cruz and Edward Norton, their intriguing upstairs neighbors who venture down for a last-minute dinner party. Wilde and Rogan's characters have conflicting motivations for the evening. She hopes to befriend them. He wants to complain about their noisy sex. The neighbors have their own agenda. The chamber piece plays like a comic Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? If the couple at the center were not master manipulators, but depleted parents fumbling to explain why they have grown so far apart. The filmmaking process was quick, unusual, and exactly the type of production Wilde always dreamed of. After reading a script by longtime writing partners Rashida Jones and Will McCormick, she pitched the writers and cast on workshopping it together. Sitting around a table in the soundstage where the pilot for I Love Lucy was filmed, the six of them tailored the roles to the actors and infused the script with arguments, embarrassments, confessions from their own relationships. Wilde brought in renowned psychotherapist Esther Perel to work with Cruz, who plays a therapist, and to offer advice on the marital ups and downs of the story. Wilde then shot the film sequentially, rare for small films and logistically impossible for larger ones, in just 21 days on a set designed to mimic a labyrinthian San Francisco apartment. In The Sprinklers, Wilde looks like a woman freed from the demands of the studio system, from the baggage of her previous film, Don't Worry, Darling, and all the gossip it spawned, from the noise that surrounded her breakup with Jason Sudeikis and subsequent relationship with Harry Styles. My character had this experience of heartbreak that was not foreign to me, she says of The Invite. The movie was in many ways plucking from experiences I've had, and it was a relief to rip my heart out of my chest and plunk it on the table. She had not, she says, known her heart needed plunking. Because of the safety of this ensemble, I felt capable of that. I remember being in the middle of a scene and realizing I was releasing something that had been embedded inside me that I had not even acknowledged was still there, she says. I thought I'd been extremely therapized. I've processed. I've worked through everything. But that is the power of catharsis through art. Though she always intended to direct the film, Wilde had to be talked into starring in it, too. She agreed only after the rest of the cast insisted she take the role of anxious Angela. I had imposter syndrome, she says. The prospect of acting opposite Edward Norton was not something I felt was in the cards for me. Until The Invite, I had more confidence as a director than as an actor. But through this process, I've kind of fallen in love with acting again. Born in New York City and raised mostly in D.C. by journalist parents, Wilde broke out in Hollywood as an icon of millennial television, with roles on The O.C. and House. She tended to play elusive women who communicated with withering looks rather than words, a stark contrast to the bubbly and talkative artist who pauses on our walk to compliment several muddy-pawed dogs. In hopes of finding more control on set, she made her foray into directing feature films with the 2019 high school graduation comedy Book Smart, a sort of spiritual sister to the 2000s comedies Rogan made with Evan Goldberg, like Superbad, the raunchy and heartfelt film positioned her alongside peers like Greta Gerwig, Jordan Peele, and John Krasinski as a successful actor-to-filmmaker crossover story. Her follow-up, Don't Worry, Darling, a thriller in the vein of The Stepford Wives, caused a media craze, to put it mildly. It began when Wilde was linked romantically with Stiles, one of the movie's stars, accelerated when she was served custody papers in her legal dispute with Sudeikis while on stage at Cinema Con, took another turn when she and Shia LaBeouf presented different narratives about his departure from the project, reached an apex when leading lady Florence Pugh skipped press opportunities, and came to a bizarre conclusion with internet sleuths analyzing a video of Stiles allegedly spitting on co-star Chris Pine at the Venice Film Festival. Both actors deny this ever happened. And that's where we're stopping, because we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. The number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.